Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Well, Jody, it's been a while since we sat down to visit. Last time we talked about your article on supersedious, which is it's a topic very near and dear to both our hearts, and had some nice comments on some of the social media stuff about how important it is and how people don't really understand it. So I think that was well received overall. We intended to record in pretty quick succession and do this one, but vacations and busy dockets and all got in the way. So we're maybe a little bit behind schedule, but it's, you know, this is still a good topic for us to discuss. And It has to do with the new petition for review process. As we said in the last episode, each of us had articles in the spring Appellate Advocate, yours on supersedious and mine on the new PFR rules. And so what we intend to do today is just to talk a little about things that are covered in my paper, maybe set the stage a little bit first on what led us to this topic, get into the some of the paper topics. Maybe I think one thing we definitely wanted to do is cover anything that varied from the preliminary rules to the final rules that were released, because we have not recorded on this topic since then. The good news is it's not a lot, but there are a few things that are maybe worth pointing out. So I'll just refer to my paper like we did yours. It's volume 35, number 2 of the Appellate Advocate. The paper's entitled A New Era in Texas Supreme Court Practice, Breaking Down the New Petition for Review Rules. That sounds very academic. It's not quite.
It does. I know. You kind of put your law professor hat on.
It's not quite that academic. And as I think we're going to talk about here as we get into it, we don't really know a lot yet to be able to get too academic about it, as strange as that sounds. So just to come back to kind of what led to this, back in episode 157, shortly after the preliminary rules were announced, we recorded an episode where we just kind of broke those down. I went into a fair amount of detail on those preliminary rules and what we thought they meant for appellate practice. And I'll refer listeners back to that episode. We'll try not to replow the same ground too much here today, although we'll have to revisit some things. But the high points were, you know, the Supreme Court decided that the two-part system, I guess three parts by the time you got to a grant and an actual opinion, was not terribly efficient. You know, it was not the best use of the court's time. It was costing the litigants a lot of money to go through a petition process, followed by a merits brief process, followed by a grant decision, and then an opinion. And so it's now been, I don't want to say consolidated, because there still are briefs on the merits, but now we've got, instead of a 4,500-word petition, we've got a 6,500-word limit petition. Merits briefs are not called for until the court has decided to grant the case. And then the grant decision and the oral argument, if it's going to be scheduled, I think in fairly quick succession, or at least the announcement of the dates comes out pretty fast.
Right. That's my understanding, is that you I think they said they've timed it where you might get one extension for briefs on the merits, but it'll be pretty quick.
Right. And so, you know, that sort of compresses the overall conveyor belt. It used to be a much longer conveyor belt. And now I think one of the ideas is that you're going to get decisions on whether the court's going to grant the case or request a response, I guess, first, pretty fast. And in my limited experience with the new rules so far, I'd say that's true. I've had a couple where I've been on each side of it, where I've filed a petition and where I've been the respondent. And in both cases, I would say there were responses requested in both cases. And in both cases, it was done, I'd say, a quicker turnaround than under the old rules. Is that been your experience?
It has.
Yeah. So one takeaway I think that we talked about in the previous episode was that the petition itself was always important, but the objective under the old rules was you wanted to flag the issue and get the court's interest. and get them to request a response. That's still, I suppose, the case. But the rule structure is a little different now where, you know, we've even started to see some cases get decided without full briefing. That was pretty rare under the old rules. And now I think it's becoming, and we expect it to become, a bit more common because of the way the setup is working with the new rules. So as far as getting into the details of the rules overall, I would suggest that listeners refer back to that episode 157. And then that, I think we're going to try to focus on maybe some things that overlap with that, but are worth mentioning again or noticing either some patterns or some practice tips and things like that that would come out of our more recent observations and those that we've distilled from other people. So let's see. Anything to add to that before we kind of launch in?
I don't think so.
I guess, you know, one trick to this is, okay, well, what do we really know? I think ideally we would have done this in a time when we originally thought we were going to get this episode out, which was shortly after the 6-month mark had passed since the new rules went into effect. This is a little longer than that, but I don't, because the court's on summer recess.
Yep.
There's nothing really happening in terms of opinions. And there's some orders coming out every Friday typically, but they're usually just a really short order set. That's usually just denials, not much happening otherwise. And so, but we are, here we are in getting on to be mid-August, and it's usually around the end of August that things start really heating up again.
Yep. They've got their long conference coming up pretty soon. And then I think we'll start seeing a lot more activity on the order list.
I think that's right. I think we're going to start seeing some grants, some cases getting moved along in the overall process. And so while there really hasn't been much happening in the last month or two, we are going to see a lot of activities coming up. And the point of that is just to say that, you know, it's going to take some time before we really know what the net effect of the new rules is. We have some ideas, as we've talked about here before, and I've written about in the paper. So this is kind of sort of the, I guess, a mid-year take on where we are. And we've got the benefit of some others' commentary on some of these topics that might be interesting to talk about a little bit in this conversation and see where it goes. But I thought I would kind of hit some of the high points from the paper without giving a CLE talk. And some of this is going to rehash some things we've already talked about, but it's worth mentioning again. And I will, by the way, drop a copy of the paper in the show notes and also in the blog post. There'll be a link to the paper there if anybody cares to read it. One of the fun, I guess, things about trying to write on a change in the law early on is you have a lot of opportunity to express strong opinions and a lot of opportunity to be wrong.
That's right. Or be right.
And so I've kind of taken the risk that some of the things I say in this paper might turn out to be wrong. And, you know, I don't regret taking any of the positions that I've taken. And it'd be interesting to see if any of it comes true. I am not a predictor of the future, but, you know, it is one of the things that's nice about having practiced as long as I have is, you know, you do see patterns over time, and it's interesting to see how things have developed, you know, since way back in the 90s when I first started in those old rules, now the former rules were first adopted. All right. So topic number one, the 1,000 word introduction. Okay. My position in this paper, I don't think this is too controversial, is that this is the most important part of your petition.
Agree.
1,000 words, you know, it wasn't a separately designated section of a petition for review before, and now it is, and the court has deemed it important enough to actually set a separate word limit on that section alone, which in my first few attempts at filing petitions for review or responses, it's added one little layer of complexity to getting the word count done.
Yeah, it does, because you've got a bunch of stuff in the middle that doesn't count. It's got to be excluded.
That's right. There are tricks to use or to get around that. But so you have to count it separately, and then you have to count it against your overall 6,500 word count. So that's fun. But, you know, the court has made it, I think, pretty clear that they think this is a very important addition. to the petition process. They deal with it specifically in the procedure summary that was attached to the final version of the rules. The one thing that they did, though, in terms of things that are different, is the proposed rule said something like the introduction, the purpose of it was to summarize the reasons the court should grant review and why the petitioner should prevail. And the final requires an introduction that, quote, identifies the most persuasive grounds for the court to grant review, which will vary by case, but will often include a reference to the substantive legal arguments. So that's, it seems like they qualified that a little bit, not quite as firm in the language.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that ultimately changes any approach that a petitioner or a respondent would take. I think it still functions the same. I mean, this is, you can make the argument, I guess, Jody, that the introduction kind of fits the same role as the old petition for review did as the attention grabber.
That's right.
And my position in the paper is, you know, this is the most important 1,000 words you're going to draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people agree with that. I'll note, though, that our good friend David Cole, who has been on the podcast, early on when these proposed rules came out, I think David took a little different position and thought that maybe the introduction, I think his words were that it could be illusory because all a justice or clerk has to do is run the petition through AI to figure out what the important parts are. I'll push back on that a little bit because I think the court has made clear that the intent here is for the justices themselves to read the introductions. And I would be a little surprised if anybody was spending a lot of time running AI separately on a petition for review or a response to call out what it means or what it says. I would tend to think that, you know, the court's told the advocates what it wants here. And it's up to the advocates to present the petition in a way that the court has said it's going to find important. So I don't know. Going back even a step further, I don't even know how much AI the Supreme Court is using in-house.
Well, yeah, I think that's an open question because knowing some of the justices up there, I'd be surprised if too many of them were relying heavily on it anyway.
Yeah. And of course, they, like everybody else, may have an issue with shadow AI. Hopefully not. But That's up to them.
We have an episode for them about proper judicial use of AI if they need some pointers
we
from a
certainly
judge in
do.
Louisiana.
We certainly do. And it's a really good episode. So yeah, it's a good reference. So as far as, I mean, I guess the one thing I could say is we encouraged people in the previous episode to get their comments in on time. And I don't know if the comments were what led to this change or really, you know, what the overall purpose of the change was that was made between the initial and the final versions. But like I said, I don't think it really changes that much that the advocates need to do. You know, I guess time will tell if David's initial assessment is right or if mine is right. And maybe we're both right. Who knows? So, but I guess the overall takeaway on the introduction is, you know, I think I would take the court at its word that the introduction is a critical part of the new petitions. And I think you would be well advised as an advocate to really focus on that as part of the drafting process. I advise in the paper doing it last. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do with my, say, is, you know, another equivalent position or an equivalent section in other briefs might be also called an introduction, but not have these particular rules applied to it. Or you might say it's kind of like the summary of the argument, which my approach is the same on those. I don't draft those until the very end because I don't know about you, but a lot of times my arguments change as I'm drafting in a brief. And so it's hard to know what the most salient point's going to be, at least in terms of persuasive argument. So no, I guess in terms of practice points, I'd still advise people to hold that one, leave it blank and do it last, but be sure you leave yourself sufficient time to do a good job with it.
I agree with that. And I think it's, to me, and I don't know if I'm saying this or if I heard one of the justices say that, but it's kind of your elevator pitch. You've got 1,000 words. It's a little bit longer because in the past, I would use the statement of jurisdiction for some of this. I would sometimes use an introduction in a petition for review, and this just sort of front loads it. And I think since they're making the grant decision off of the petitions, then just, yeah, do your elevator speech. Here's the 3 or 4 pages that explain what the important issue is and why we win. And I know that the rule doesn't require that specifically, but effectively that's what they want to know. So that's what I'm using it for.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I do like the elevator pitch description too. I think that's accurate. Okay, I think we've exhausted that topic, essentially. I mean, you could make, I guess you could get into what's the different strategy for a respondent. You know, do you want to be arguing about importance to the jurisprudence of the state in an introduction as a respondent, or do you want to be focused on the merits argument? And that, it does tie into some points we'll cover later about, well, this may be the only brief you get to file. So I guess you need to be careful, really, from both perspectives. Is we're going to talk about what may or may not be happening with per curiams a little bit later in this conversation. But, you know, if it is, in fact, the only brief you get to file, I'm not sure you want to spend an inordinate amount of time talking about importance to the jurisprudence of the state, at least as a respondent, or maybe as a petitioner, because the court's going to make that decision, you know, on its own. It's going to think the case is important or it's not. If there's a reason why you need to make the case that it's important, then by all means, you should include that. But I'd say in most cases, the importance is, I mean, especially if you've got a split among the courts of appeals or something, you know, the classic grounds, you know, a dissent in the court of appeals, something like that. That's something that I think you have to weigh carefully in how you use that 1,000 words.
I don't know. I'll disagree a little bit. I think I would, to the extent you can, point out problems. If there's a vehicle problem, if it's there's some facts that don't allow it to really answer the question that they're posing, because I've had that happen. Someone will say, oh, it's the controlling legal question is this, but the reality is it's not because of the way that the Court of Appeals decided the case or what the record is. And I think it's important because sometimes that straddles both lines. It's a merits issue plus it's not important because you don't really get to answer the question that they want you to answer. Or, you know, maybe there's not actually a split even though they've played it up as one. So I think that there's a balance there where you probably need to at least address a little bit of both if you can. Sometimes you can't. There's just a split in the Court of Appeals.
Well, I can't disagree with you. I think it's just going to vary by case. If you've got an argument that the court, this, you know, the classic approach is, well, okay, I see the point that the petitioner's making, but this isn't the right case to address this issue. I think the court's generally pretty receptive to that, even if it isn't otherwise kind of a hot button issue. You know, if you have, say, for example, preservation issues or something like that, I think it is going to depend on the case. I don't mean to offer any kind of blanket observation on what to do. I just think you have to evaluate all of it in terms of, from the advocate's perspective, you know, what's going to be important to the court, and just weigh it all together.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
Okay, second topic. We covered this to some degree in the previous episode, the issues presented in having to include appropriate citations to the record, demonstrating that the issue was preserved, and merits briefs too. I guess you don't want to change your issues. it really should be the same thing, right?
It should.
So I didn't read this as any, you know, any signal that the court was looking to tinker around with preservation of error. I think the court just wants to know, just show us that your error was preserved.
That's right. It's kind of what we just talked about. If there's a problem that's going to keep them from considering this question, they just want to know up front so that they're not wasting their time trying to go through the case and learn about the merits when it turns out that it's actually something that was waived all along.
Yeah.
Which, in fairness, the Texas Supreme Court doesn't seem to hold as tightly as some of the intermediate courts of appeals, but I don't know.
In fairness. Fairness to whom?
The litigants, actually, depending on which side you're on. You know, they really want cases decided on the merits, which I think is a good thing overall, broadly. Now, I'll gripe about it in individual cases, obviously, but, you know, it's not a bad thing for us hardworking appellate lawyers out there.
I agree with that. You know, and look, I understand the court wanting to know that error is preserved, but, you know, why let preservation of error get in the way of a good opinion?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are other states that have had these rules for a long time. And so I don't think it hurts to have them doing it. I wouldn't be surprised if we see something like that in the courts of appeals at some point for the same reasons.
So in the petitions that you've done so far, how have you handled that? I mean, I just literally put record citations.
I do too.
In my issues.
That's right. That's what I do too. And then in the statement of facts, sometimes I'll drop a footnote or expand it. I mean, a lot of times it's pretty obvious. Did you make a charge objection? Did you move for JNOV or motion to modify or whatever? Or, you know, how'd you preserve legal and factual sufficiency type stuff. So it's that's what I do too, is just stick record sites in there.
It feels weird at first.
It does.
It's like, never had to do that before, mm-hmm. but you know, it does make you think, all right, is this issue preserved? Can I show the Supreme Court that this has been addressed at the appropriate time and place? Typically in the trial court, I mean, I suppose it's possible it could be in the Court of Appeals, but the idea is, you know, be prepared to show your work on error preservation and for good reason. It also, I think maybe we covered this last time, it's a good way to sort of triage issues with your trial counsel.
That's right.
You know, you can't, it should be pretty apparent to a trial lawyer who feels really strongly about something. If you can't point to where in the record that issue was preserved, you got to make a hard decision really quick on whether that issue gets raised at all, because you may have That's other right. better issues, or other issues at least that the error was preserved on. So
yeah,
I like that. I like that rule, honestly.
I do too.
And I think it's useful. So until no it
comes
there,
comes back and bites me in the butt. But for now, I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we don't really know anything yet about how the rules work. So
that's right.
Hopefully that doesn't happen as far as getting bitten by the rule. But you mm-hmm. know, because it is the expectation that error is preserved, I think it's a reasonable rule.
No, I do too.
Actually kind of like it once I've gotten past the awkwardness of putting record citations in my issue statements.
Is this the place we want to talk about no more unbriefed issues?
That was next on my list.
Okay, so there we go. I'll let you get to it then.
Okay. Yeah. So the old rules, you know, you would often have two or three issues presented that were specifically argued in the petition for review, and then a list of unbriefed issues that you didn't have room to argue necessarily in the petition for review, especially with a 4,500 word limit. But essentially you were preserving for the merits brief if you got to that point. I've used them. I've seen them used many, many, many times. There's no point in even debating whether they were useful or not now, because they're gone. Okay. The new rule says basically that you've got to include every issue that you intend to raise in the statement of issues in the petition for review. So, you know, you might have had two or three or more throwaway issues in your petition for review that should not be included now. Every issue in the petition must be argued in the petition. Is there anything really more to say about that, though? Or do you have any follow-up on that?
The only thing that I wish, and this is not related to the Supreme Court practice, is judges in Texas that issue very broad general rulings then makes it harder to appeal those things at the Court of Appeals, because you have to raise every possible ground for it. And then when you filter up to this Supreme Court, you know, sometimes you have something that you feel compelled to include, because if you don't, then you're waiving basically your case. And that just, that funnel effect, I think, creates some issues when you can't leave it unbriefed. But I've only done a few of these so far under the new rules, so it hasn't come up yet, but that's just one place where I could see this being a problem, because it's maybe not an issue you feel strongly about, but if you don't include it, then they're going to say, aha, you haven't challenged every ground, and therefore there's no basis for you to review this case. And you know,
I think about that kind of thing coming up mostly in summary judgment context.
Yeah, I think that's where I see it a lot.
Or you've got to challenge every potential ground if the grounds aren't specifically stated in the order. I wonder if one solution to that problem, maybe it's not a solution, I mean, you still have to brief it, but in your issue statement, you could, the statement itself could be a bit broader. You know, did the trial court err by granting summary judgment? It's not a great Supreme Court issue.
Right.
But it's broad.
That's right. No, that's right. Well, the good news is I understand that trial judges are no longer going to grant summary judgments based on the new rules. So I think we've eliminated that problem.
That's a whole nother conversation.
We've had that conversation a couple of times.
So many times.
So that may sort itself out.
It may. Let's see. I think this again comes back to, it's kind of like it has the same sort of net effect that the error preservation citations has in terms of the unbriefed issues. It encourages advocates to be selective in the issues that they choose. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's a good thing to encourage.
It is.
Because most people, the people that do this for a living and are Supreme Court advocates, would tell you that usually the more issues you have, the worse your petition is. And the less chance, the more remote chance it has of success. One point that I made pretty pointedly in the article is, or at least raised the issue of, are we going to see more per curiams? the court, basically the structure of the rules essentially set it up so that we might expect more. There's a whole tension between that idea and the Supreme Court not being an error correcting court. And I've taken the position, I think even in the last time we recorded on this, and certainly in the paper, that no, it's not an error correcting court, but there's certainly more opportunity to correct error now than ever before, because we've got it built in to the new petition process that you may not actually get a brief on the merits. You know, the court can actually decide cases on the petition and response alone. And so I tend to think still that this leans toward an increase in number of PCs. But again, we've said that, you know, it's too early to tell, and that's 100% true.
I hope that it does. That's my hope with this, because I definitely have filed petitions in the past thinking, I'm not sure that I have much else to say in a brief on the merits.
Yeah.
You know, either they're going to agree with me that this is right or they're not. And, you know, we can add another 20 pages of argument and beef it up a little bit, but the real basic issues in the record and the law are all laid out right here. Mm-hmm. 4,500 words, and they could probably write a per curiam opinion and fix it. And I hope they do, because I think that that's better for everyone, given the small number of argument settings that they're able to have each year. Great. I mean, you know, I don't expect them to put on an equal number of PCs to the number of argued cases, but if they even did a, you know, up their percentage by 10 or 20%, that's still a lot more cases, which is a great thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one reason, again, it's worth pointing out that one reason we don't have much information on this yet is just because of the time of year it is.
I think there's still a lot of old ones in the pipeline. I have maybe two or three up there under the new rules, and everything else I've had in that court, a lot of it that's been pending for before the rules went into effect is still there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, it's going to take, I think, probably another year or so to really clear out all of that and only be operating under these new rules.
I think that's right. Because, yeah, we can't forget that there's still a pretty good universe of cases there that are still going to have the old rules apply to them. And so it's interesting that my observation, the case I had kind of pulled as my poster child for PC reversals, is the In Re JDH case from back in June. And it was a PC reversal and a parental termination case. And it was 6-3. So it drew a dissent in a PC, which is
interesting.
And it's actually, you know, yeah, I was trying to remember. It is a PC and not a signed opinion. And I was trying to remember the trigger that caused a PC to turn into a signed opinion. I think it has to do with when they don't have 6 votes. So I'm backtracking in my mind a little bit. But here, so we did have in that case, and Don Cruz talked about it in his UT appellate seminar paper. And I think his take on it, from what I understand, is, and Don, I think, would be the first to tell you, hey, it's too early. But I think Don's take on that case, it was a 25 docket number.
Okay.
So it wasn't filed, for one thing, it wasn't filed under the new rules, but it was a PC reversal without merits briefing, which was not done very much under the old rules.
It really wasn't at all.
So I'm not sure that it really is a proper test case for my theory of more PC reversals. So I guess the bottom line in terms of this conversation is we shall see, but it was sort of noteworthy. Don, I should add the other part of Don's take, as I understand it to be, and, you know, this is probably a good time to mention that we'd love to have Don. Don, I'll talk to you. We'd love to have you come on and give us a more thorough retrospective of this when we have more data. And I know you're going to be looking at this stuff too. So it'd probably be much more interesting for people who care about this topic to not hear it just from me and you, Jody, the next time
That's
we
right.
talk about it.
Somebody who's actually out there crunching the numbers like Don.
The number crunching appellate lawyer would be a good one to talk to about this. So I was thinking at first that case maybe supported an observation that, oh, look what the Supreme Court's doing. But the second part of Don's take on this, as I understand it, is it may have had just as much to do with the court was trying to get its clear its docket for the spring. Although I don't think that case was argued, but it may or may not be the best indicator of a predictor of anything.
Well, and I think parental termination cases are different. I don't know at the Texas Supreme Court stage, but I know at every other stage they have really tight statutory deadlines.
Yeah, I think that's something else that may set that case apart. So I guess in terms of, but back to what you're saying about how you approach briefing in certain cases, you know, I have unashamedly I have briefed petitions in the Supreme Court under the new rules, specifically asking the court to PC reverse.
Oh, I've done that under the old rules too, because I think sometimes it's accurate. That's what needs to happen.
Right. So I see, and I think I make this point in the paper, I see the shift, the slight shift in the way the rules are structured and the Supreme Court's explicit authority to rule on cases without merits briefs as an invitation for more of those kinds of petitions. And in my case, I suspect maybe yours, the ones you've done too, you can make the argument that, look, this is clear. It's clear as day. Court of Appeals got it wrong. And here's what you should do. PC reverse it. Here's the reasons. A whole lot more to say. So yeah, I mean, I specifically, I've got one pending right now that we will see if that's what they do. And if they do, then I guess I'll update the paper and cite that.
There you go.
If they don't, you know, I don't know what you can take away from that, but okay.
Appellate courts have demanding procedural requirements. That's why you need an expert who understands the complexities of every court nationwide. Since 1938, Counsel Press has been the trusted partner of the Am Law 100, providing unmatched expertise in appellate services from e-brief preparation to electronic filing. Their team manages document review and compliance, ensuring your appeals in expert hands from start to finish. Counsel Press, your trusted partner in every appeal. Visit counselpress.com today.
The next topic I had was just the timetable and some internal procedure changes. I think in my experience so far, it is turning out to be true that the court is acting upon petitions, at least in terms of requesting responses, pretty quickly. The old rules, you basically, unless you filed a waiver letter, you know, the petition would sit there for 30 days or so before it would get mm-hmm. kicked upstairs. And now there's no more waiver letters. So please don't do that if you're a respondent in the Supreme Court. And I felt affirmed on that, by the way, when I got a postcard from our good friend Blake Hawthorne saying the Supreme Court no longer considers waiver letters or something like that, and acknowledging a petition for review was filed. That language like that or to that effect was actually adopted into the old postcard format notice that you get when the petition's filed. So I can say, I think definitively now that the court agrees with us, don't file waiver letters. But as far as the accelerated clock, I think that is turning out to be true. You're hearing something from the court fairly quickly, especially if the court is going to request a response. And I think we cleared up that under the new rules, it really, and this was always the rule, I think, it really only took one judge to request a response. So
that's right.
One question that comes out of that is, you know, what do we read into the fact that a response was requested? And probably not a lot still.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And I think Don maybe tracked the numbers. And I believe his conclusion was that the number of response requests was actually up, which wouldn't really surprise me. So not a whole lot to say, I don't think, a whole lot more to say on that, other than the other thing besides don't file waiver letters anymore, just confirming that for sure. If you get grants, you know, be sure and get your vacation letters on file.
That is true. That was never something that was a concern in the Supreme Court before now.
No. And there's another little thought I had about the way that the new process may change things a little. And that is, you know, in the old days, when you got a merits or you got a response requested, you know, okay, somebody was interested in the case. That's great. But then you had the brief on the merits request. And now you don't have that anymore, other than the court's already decided it's going to take the case. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the old days, you still had a lag between the merits brief request and submission. That lag is now gone.
That's right.
So one question I want to throw out there is, I wonder what that is going to do to cases that might otherwise settle while the petition's pending and while there's a merits brief. Their merits brief stage is actively going on, because shortening the timeline, I think you would find that there are some cases that might have otherwise settled that may not, or you think it's going to have the opposite effect that.
Well, I don't know. There is something to knowing, either as the petitioner or the respondent, that the court has granted your case. Now, that doesn't guarantee you a win as the petitioner, but it certainly takes your odds of success from, you know, what, 8 or 10% up to above 50%, which significantly impacts settlement dynamics. And I think the inverse is true on the other side. You felt pretty confident going in and, okay, yeah, their grants have gone up from, you know, 10% to whatever it was, 33 or 45 when briefs on the merits were requested. But when the court's granted the case and you're the respondent, you need to have some serious worry about what happens if the court goes their way, because it very well might. They don't necessarily take cases to affirm.
Yeah, I want to say that the number that Don cited in his paper was like 83% of grants were reversed.
Yeah.
Which is huge. It's commonly known. I mean, the phrase you hear is the Supreme Court does not grant to affirm. I bet you've heard David Keltner say that once or twice.
No, and that is absolutely true. It's just, it does look very different, I think, when the court has already granted the petition and set it for argument, and now you're briefing the merits versus, you know, you're briefing the merits. Totally. Maybe they'll take it, maybe they won't. That is a much clearer signal. And obviously you can take the position of, well, when we lay it on our merits brief, they'll really understand it and they couldn't get the context from the petition. But I don't know. We'll see. And who knows? I mean, you know, maybe we're going to find that by granting and then doing merits briefs, the reversal rate does go down. I have no idea, but
I don't either. And I could not make a confident prediction.
No.
Either way.
It's so case specific, it's hard to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to see the stats, and a whole bunch of stats that can be pulled out of this eventually to know. So Don, you know, get to work. Okay. Well, those are the kind of the main points that I wanted to cover. There's a couple of other little things that are worth mentioning, I think. One is, and you tell me if this has been the case for you, but, you know, we do have a new requirement that all motions, I think, except motions for rehearing, actually have a word count limit now. And that, I think, is flying under the radar. I see motions.
Until you get rejected, and then you call the court and say, why do I have to put a word count on my extension motion? Yes, I'm familiar. Which it is kind of funny when there's a word count required, but there's not a word limit on some of them. But yeah, hey, whatever.
A lot of sense.
It's their world.
But it is. So that's something to be mindful of. Although I will confess that I haven't always included a word count in my extension motions. And so far, I haven't been bounced. So I think, I'm not sure the clerks are really enforcing that one, but I'll tell you one that they are, at least in the Supreme Court, is you better have your appendix in the proper order.
Yes, they are.
Because I have seen opponents, not me, because I've studied the rules, but I have seen opponents' petitions get bounced for not having the appendix put together properly. So the court is very serious about that.
You know, one thing while you mentioned that I can't remember if it's happened at the Supreme Court, but I have seen it in courts of appeals recently, is screenshots that have words in them.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not including that in your word count, depending on where you end up filing it, the court may send it back to you and say, oh, no, this needs to be in your word count. And if you're at close to your word limit and you have screenshots with words in them, like pictures from a contract or something, it may be that you have to revise your brief. So I'll just put that out there as a thing that I'm aware is happening in some courts and not others. So just be careful.
No, that's a great point. I mean, I that issue has always been out there. With people including more and more screenshots in briefs, I do it.
Yeah, well, I do too.
But yeah, I think if you're, especially if you're near word count limits, that's something you've got to be mindful of. Okay, let's see how we wrap this up. So the introduction section, I talked about the change from the preliminary rule to the final rule. There was also a change in the mandamus rule that kind of went the other way on introductions. The introductions and mandamuses must summarize the reasons to grant relief and the legal arguments made in the body of the petition. And I think it was our friend Andrew Gould on his Substack said he thought that may have come about because there's no summary of the argument section in a mandamus that's required. So I thought that was interesting. The rule's a little different on the introduction section with the mandamus, so be sure you read that standing apart from the petition for review rule. We've already talked about Don Cruz and his tracking of the data. Let's see what he says. He says response request rate was about 50% under the new rules versus roughly 45% historically. This was as of about midsummer. There had not been any merits briefing orders yet because they weren't setting anything for argument, I guess. And so we don't really know what the bigger effect is going to be on the stats. The one other thing to say, and then we can wrap it up, is we did have something that kind of does play into the whole piece analysis, is we had the Supreme Court issue a GVR, grant vacate and remand, in the Noyes versus State Ex Rel Voges case on May 15th. That is something that we haven't really seen in Texas jurisprudence. And so back to the point about, you know, the Court of Appeals clearly got it wrong. You know, write your petition specifically for a PC. I think this kind of thing, GVRs have been very common in the U.S. Supreme Court for forever. And we've kind of seen the federalization of our state appellate practice overall. And I think this is, I think it's a logical next step. If you know there's an important case pending in the Texas Supreme Court and it touches upon an issue that the Court of Appeals has decided in your case that they think got it wrong, file a petition and specifically ask for a GVR.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they may be willing to do it.
They very well might. Okay. Well, I think that covers what I wanted to talk about today. I would suggest anybody who wants to read the paper, read it. If you disagree with me, feel free to let me know on anything. Like I said, I didn't mind kind of taking a stab at trying to put something out there that I hope is helpful to people who are trying to tackle dealing with petitions and responses and briefs and mandamuses and under these new rules. But if we're going to leave with one specific thought today, it is, you know, the rules are final. Be sure and look at them before you file a petition or a response.
That's right.
Or a merits brief. Don't rely on your old forms, your old templates.
Yeah, that's very true.
And stay tuned because it's probably going to be, I think you're right, Jody. I think we're probably looking at another year or even two before we get any real significant, meaningful data that comes out of this new process that tells us anything about how it really changes appellate practice in the Supreme
Court. I don't know. I have a feeling we'll be back every few months to have this conversation on stuff that we've seen and what you can mine from the kind of limited data that we have. Because I think a year from now, it really will look a lot different. I looked on Don's website before we started recording and the number of, like, for example, the number of petitions that are still pending under the old rules versus, you know, ones where briefs have been requested, like that continues to shrink. And so at a certain point, it's going to be much, much smaller numbers and you can kind of tell what the court's doing with the regular petitions.
We knew it was going to take a while for those old ones to get cleared out. I mean, the court's still maintaining both systems while it's getting the old ones resolved. Yeah, I think it's fair to say as those numbers go down and eventually completely get cleared out, you know, we'll have the true picture of what the lasting impact of these rule changes is going to be. All right. Well, thank you, sir. As always, appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, me too.
We'll resume with a topic that, well, I can't promise that neither one of us has ever written an article about it. we've done a number of things over the years, but we'll get back to having some guests on the show. And
that's right.
We'll look forward to presenting more interesting conversations to our listeners and viewers.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.